Today's talk is given by Ian Mackay of the Improvement Service, and his talk is entitled One Scotland Gazetteer, Where Are We Now? Ian has a background in land surveying and is a graduate of Glasgow University, and Ian has the honour of being an early user of GPS while working overseas, and tells me that in 1982 it took 4 days to get enough satellite passes to get a fix to the nearest 10 metres. So you don't know how lucky you are, or you do now. In the mid-1980s, he returned to Scotland, where he worked for the well-known to many of you Mason Land Surveys. And then later, he worked for Strathclyde Regional and Glasgow City Councils before being seconded and later moving full-time to the Improvement Service, where he now works on developing the Gazetteer and other geographic information. So without further ado, over to Ian.
Thank you. Good afternoon. As Owen said, I work for the Improvement Service, which is a company owned by local government and the Scottish Government. And better start off by stressing what I say today is my views, not necessarily anyone else's. They are certainly not. Bruce invited me to talk about gazetteers and what we're doing. And it was a curious email. It had a sentence in it which combined addressing and interesting in the same sentence. You don't hear that very often, so I just couldn't turn it down. Put together a title, Where Are We Now? One of our directors sort of picked this up off the photocopier and said, surely after 8 years we do know where we are, that's the point. But I think this is probably nearer it. Let you read that. Make any mention. One thing that proves is the LBJ never gave a presentation on addressing. And I'm assuming everybody knows who LBJ, who he is. He was 36th President of the United States after Kennedy was assassinated. So I'm going to talk about addressing for about an hour. It's a bit of a challenge, to be honest, to keep it going for an hour talking about addressing, but it's easier than listening to it. The Improvement Services are a consultancy. We do a lot of consultancy work, so as with everything we do, we set some targets, be specific, talk about addresses, measure it by how many people are still here. I think it's achievable. Realistic, you might not. And time bound, so we've got about an hour, so if we just go through this from here. This is really what I want to go through. There's a number of different strands to follow, and what I really want to do is try to show how all of these things fit together in a sort of overall sort of picture of where we're trying to go. I wasn't too sure. I've only been to one or two of these before, staying in the sort of chosen part of the country in the West Coast. So I'd asked Cameron, and Cameron had given me a bit of advice. He said, just sort of spend an hour, cover as many sort of these things as you can, put them together and just get some questions out of it. And I was listening to something on the radio earlier this week, and I just caught part of the news, and it was something about an incoherent ramble full of rhetoric from a delusional despot which lasted about an hour. I just thought, so be careful.
You bring your umbrella with you.
And also in that line, I won't be referring to any organisation or anyone as cockroaches who must be crushed. Okay, addressing. Addressing is pretty straightforward, isn't it? Everyone knows that we're addressing. Possibly you can't read that. 43.5. Or two number 19s on adjacent doors. These guys can all sort it out. Postman, a human can actually go and look at it and make sense of which is the number 19, probably the name and that. But computers are probably not too good at it. It's quite difficult to put that sort of intelligence into it. And these guys didn't either. That was, I can't remember where it was, but it was about 5:30 in the morning, a school crossing warden was in a cup, early morning cup of tea, and these gentlemen arrived in through the front window, wrong house. So addressing can be quite important. The programme itself began in 2003 with modernising government funding. of £10 million went in from central government and local government. There was a lot of funding went into this and got up the original name of the programme was DNA Scotland. That's a cracking acronym, that, wasn't it? DNA Scotland. Certainly found some of the time, even get MSPs interested in it, briefly, until they found out this stood for the Definitive National Address. It then became the National Gazetteer for Scotland, and then the One Scotland Gazetteer. What it's really involved doing is getting all 32 councils to do the same thing, challenge, of building their local address gazetteers, working to common standards, follow the British standard, their own conventions for it. That was all put together in 2007. It supports a programme which the Improvement Service are behind called Customer First, which involves a citizen account and the national infrastructure. I'll explain a wee bit more about that later on. And it supports a couple of, or several now, live applications through web services and the supply of data to organisations. This is a pretty simple schematic of how the whole thing's put together. The property database over here, this sort of part of it over here, is the main part of the Customer First programme. And the One Scotland Gazetteer was developed as a standalone application initially by SOPRA, that was in 2006, and we've just redeveloped the whole gazetteer management system by a company called Connect Internet Solutions. And with four main ways of accessing the gazetteer, through web services, which is our preferred way, and if time permits I can show some of that working, through downloads, change-only updates, and a product that is in development at the moment, which is we're calling it OSG Lite, which is a very simplified version of the gazetteer. The actual gazetteer itself, because it conforms to BS 7666, is a hideously complicated structure that's fairly unwieldy. So there is a demand to produce a very simple version of it, and that should be available in the next couple of weeks. The bit over on the right-hand side there, that's really the foundation that was developed to build modern public services for Scotland, isn't it? And it really involves joining people to addresses. And you've got a database of people in Scotland, a database of addresses, and applying for the entitlement card basically joins the people in addresses. Now that's a very, very powerful demographic tool, but it's also fraught with difficulties with data protection and what have you. This was one my father-in-law threw at me, Christmas Day of all things. If anyone's not seen that before, how do you get a person and an address out of that? As I said, it was Christmas Day, short of things to do. Right, back to basics. What's the gazetteer? Well, if you look at it, it's an index of geographical place names, or an index of land or property holdings, or I prefer the bit, it's just the bit at the back of an atlas where you find where to go to look for the information. And that's really the case for the gazetteer, the One Scotland Gazetteer. It doesn't itself contain an awful lot of data. It only holds the geographic addresses of an object, but it does provide a reference through the UPRN on how to attach to other land property information. Because it conforms to BS 7666, it differs from other addressing products, which tend to be flat list files of addresses. And the concept is built around the basic land and property unit. And the basic land and property unit is actually refers to the real world object, to what the thing actually is. And associated with each land and property, basic land and property unit, you've got a land and property identifier, which holds the address part of the information. And you can have more than one of these. There's a bit of an underworld illusion there, which if you've ever been to that part of Ayrshire, you'd probably understand. Saying that Cumnock's one of these places, as you leave it, there's three road signs. The white circle with the black diagonal, national speed limit. Thank you for driving safely. And if you think that was bad, wait till you get to Auchinleck. In fact, I was reading the Glasgow Herald coming through on the train, and there's actually a thing in the Herald Diary today from a Cumnock resident who'd said that the air gun shooting of the 15 pupils at Auchinleck Academy earlier this week shocked everyone in Cumnock. They didn't know Auchinleck had a school. Probably very unkind. Okay, the point being though that the gazetteer allows you to reference all sorts of different properties about a land and property thing, and that's just some of the things registered against one UPRN. So really what we're saying is how you see a property will very much be determined by what your application is, why you're interested in it, and what it looks like. But the gazetteer itself provides a way of referencing all that sort of information together so that we can start to draw all of that together, probably using web services. I'll talk a wee bit about that as we go on, and just produce a complete picture of what's going on at the property. Some thoughts also about joining some of this stuff up and displaying it. A typical suburban bit, or atypical because it's West Kilbride and it's blue sky, but there's a row of houses along the top there, semi-detached houses, gardens in front, a pathway along that, grassy banking and the public park. That's the picture of what we're looking at. If we look at it from the map, suspiciously like landline, and put the building seat points on it, that's pretty straightforward. That makes a lot of sense. It's quite easy to do. There's a fairly straightforward example of where a gazetteer fits the geography pretty simply. If you then try sort of balkanising the data, a sort of early attempt, very early attempt at master maps or idea, and then trying to say, well, each of these properties, what actually are the extents of them, you would probably infer that that's a pretty good start of where the cartilage of the property is, as inferred by the physical features. But in fact, the legal titles of these properties actually go right across the path, right down to the public park. So each one of these houses owns a bit of that grass in front. So really trying to infer the extents of a property from what you can see on the map generally might be a good idea, but I don't personally think so. Okay, we're moving forward with the gazetteer. As I said, we're redeveloping it at the moment with Connect Internet Solutions. We've just finished phase four, the last phase of the implementation. We're doing some tidy up work at the moment. Conforms to BS 7666, the 2006 version of it. We're slightly different for the gazetteer in England and Wales in terms of classifications, the way we've approached that, and also linking addresses to physical to streets. The standard says you must link an address to a street. England and Wales have said any linear feature, such as a canal. Now, as you know, you can't drive down a canal, although West Lothian, I think, someone did, but that's what happened.
You've got quite a long way as well,
I have to do. Yes, I don't think it was the first time either. So, we've also got new conventions, which basically determine what's in the gazetteer and how some of this stuff's structured. And for that, we've been involving the people who are actually using it, listening to them rather than the people who are just creating the gazetteer. We've got more frequent updates, better data management. Councils now, whenever they're ready, at any point, they can take their gazetteer and upload either changes or a complete refresh of the gazetteer. They have to do it every month. Many of them are doing it weekly. Some of them are wanting to put changes up every day. And that's going to improve the frequency of that. we've got also we've got better quality assurance of it, and we've also got the capability to customise web services more to meet what customers are looking for. Next few slides are pretty dry, I'll be honest, but I think there's a lot of work going into this, so I'll spend a wee bit of time going through them. The Gazetteer is a quality assured product, and we would consider it certainly superior to any of the other addressing products around just now, certain types of accuracy and currency, completeness and consistency. Others may take a slightly different view. We're already getting Scottish Government departments who are using it or deriving benefits from it. We've got the capabilities to manage it and to look after the data of interaction with the 32 councils, because that's no small task in itself to keep the 32 councils on board. I've already mentioned the new solution for it, and there's a very good network within the Gazetteer community of people involved in keeping it up to date, and also with organisations, Ordnance Survey, Royal Mail and others, that it's not something that local government's trying to do in isolation. There are some challenges, not least there's no funding arrangements in place beyond 2012, but that's true of any Scottish public sector organisation, even Scottish Government, because the budgets haven't been set for 1 year this year. We'll go into a 3-year budgeting thereafter. It's not something just aimed at the Gazetteer. We have got an issue that the supply of the data comes from the councils, and they're not legally bound into supplying data. But they are covered by an SLA, and the fact that most of the services that we're building, things like the entitlement card, and that depend on them keeping their data up to date, they can't provide the services if their Gazetteer's not kept up to date, and that seems to be quite a powerful driver for them. There is a potential for increasing the amount of information that's linked to the Gazetteer, be it ownership, property descriptions, who's the proprietor, tenant, occupier, valuation. These can all be addressed, but there's a big process of address matching needs to go in. And the last two, we've always had knowledge that there's commercial organisations interested in the Gazetteer itself, and there's also a demand for the Gazetteer at a GB level. And the One Scotland Gazetteer itself didn't have a policy on the brokerage of information, and I'll talk to that at the end as we look at what's happening at a national level on that. We're all working at a challenging time here, and the Gazetteer is actually a really good example of 32 councils working together to a common purpose and actually delivering something. There's a big demand for location information, and we've also got a ready-made market through the One Scotland mapping agreement, which covers the Scottish public sector, which allows us to license the Gazetteer to these people. We can add organisations in to keep the data up to date. We've been talking to the assessors about that, but then directly being able to update information rather than a sort of convoluted path through councils. And we're also working with Registers of Scotland to replace the Registers Gazetteer with the One Scotland Gazetteer and provide access to allow them to edit it online. And there's opportunities for partners and alliances to share in the development of it. And again, National Address Gazetteer covers that all. These. Just some of the strategic objectives that we set for the Gazetteer, and we're fairly comfortable, we're pretty well on course to actually deliver on these. I think one of the key ones there is the public policy framework at local, regional, national and European level. What we're looking at there is Inspire, which I'll describe a bit, but where I see this fitting together in here. So I mentioned the One Scotland mapping agreement has been a way to fund or to organise the licensing behind this. So I'll just talk a little bit about it. You probably recognise these slides have been plagiarised from Cameron's, certainly some of the diagrams. I'm sure there'll be a rip for suing your IPR, Cameron.
Absolutely. Yeah. As long as it's in public sector, you're okay.
Okay. So really, the One Scotland Mapping Agreement had really
The main objectives were to make sure that everyone in Scotland can use the most up-to-date and accurate geographic information that can be delivered with the best use of resources, and develop and promote means whereby geographic information can be shared, again within the limits of best value that comes by, to give high quality knowledge in a return for each set of data. That's really where the One Scotland Mapping Agreement started. 72 original members of it, central government, non-departmental government bodies, local government emergency services, NHS. We've actually extended that up to 95 organisations now are signed up to it. And to get all of this as an integrated, coordinated approach between central and local government, it was a groundbreaker to actually get central and local government working together on an agreement like this. You might think that cartoon, just looking at it again in the train, one of Cameron's famous cartoons, but it's a period depiction of the scene when Duncan offered Vanessa 10 and 6 months for the One Scotland Mapping Agreement. As you can see by the look in her face, it wasn't enough for the return.
Never thought of that one.
Flying
the wall picture.
Okay, why did we do this again, the One Scotland Mapping Agreement? Well, the previous agreements just weren't working. They were considerably outdated. Could actually suggest that they were run from London more from the UK level, and Scotland was only just sort of tacked on at the edge of it. So we decided, or it was decided, that we would go down a sort of Scottish route. We had the initial discussions with the Ordnance Survey, which I was trying to remember. I think that the Ordnance Survey approached Scottish Government first of all on this, rather than the other way around.
I stuck in my ass.
You did. Yeah. It actually gives a vision of Dominic there as some sort of siren luring us into the clutches of the Ordnance Survey's lawyers, which is quite disturbing. But, yeah. But it had to be a crown-to-crown agreement. That was fundamental to it, for it to work, to get away from this idea of tendering for products, what have you. Councils, local government is not Crown, but again, the formal concordat between the Scottish ministers and local government provided enough guarantees that we could use this, use the Crown to Crown agreement to do this. The One Scotland Mapping Agreement itself comes in two documents, a framework agreement which basically describes the general principles of what we were trying to do, definitions, something about payment and products. And each member of the organisation has a member's licence agreement, which basically tells you what you can't do with the data, which is a big improvement from the previous situation where you get a document which tells you what you could do with it. So it's actually an awful lot better to know what you can't do with it. These documents, by the way, were started off as tiny little things that Duncan McNiven drafted, and once the lawyers got hold of them, they managed to enlarge them somewhat enormously. And the agreement itself is managed by SOSLO, or as it could be sounded, So Slow, which is unfortunate, which is a representative from each of the sectors who are involved in the agreement. And that's actually worked pretty well. And I think a lot of what was done in Scotland in that was taken on the PSMA to actually show that the parties involved in this could actually sit down around the table and have a sensible discussion with an escalation path that things didn't get resolved, which we've never had to use so far, 2 years. So far, he said. That's just the organisations, and that was the actual formal signing of the agreement in April 2009, May 2009. Yep. Okay, so what's really been the benefits of the One Scotland Mapping Agreement? I think it's been certainly been involved in the MSA, it's a lot more pleasant, productive way of working in these things. It's a partnership rather than a contractual agreement, and there's been minimal input from lawyers.
which are a common theme to keep things simple. We've been able to understand the constraints and issues of both sides, and we've always managed to understand the Ordnance Survey's views on IPR. We don't necessarily agree with them, but we can think we can understand them. We've managed to add value through take-up of products. Quite a lot of government organisations have been able to get access to products that hitherto they couldn't afford to do under the PGA. There's one administrative cost, one payment really, from Scottish Government, although there's a lot of paddling goes on in the background to get that money into a budget. And it's given us the opportunities to pilot some new products. What we're trying to do now is get the maximum benefit from the agreement and look at some of the benefits from partnership approach. And I think this is where it was really quite interesting. The short-term top slice payment or the long-term pay for usage, that whole discussion of a payment for the agreement is really hotting up very much in the last couple of weeks. So finally, for this bit, looking at the One Scotland Mapping Agreement, it was set up in response to the GI strategy for Scotland. It was put together. It does what it said, what we set out to do. And it has been a success. I mean, it really was groundbreaking at its time. And from the gazetteer point of view, it provided a way to license the One Scotland Gazetteer for the public sector in Scotland. So everything's going along fine. And then, you may remember that, get chat, not that long ago. That put a bit of a change to it. We've got a number of free products from the Ordnance Survey. Sometimes it's a strange concept of free. Free with strings attached, which is that free? I don't know. But these were the products initially announced as free, and you would notice that in that there's no addressing products free at the moment. We also, I won't say get hit, but along came the INSPIRE, the European Directive on Spatial Data Infrastructure, and Scottish ministers signed that in December 31st of December as well. And it didn't come at the best time. It came whenever everyone's budgets were just beginning to shrink. They hadn't started to shrink to the extent they are now. And we need to really, if we're going to be serious and do this, we need to do some of these things that we have there, streamline what we're doing, rationalise, deliver efficiencies and create shared services. If you actually look at the thing that, I think that's one of Bill Bryson's books, about the Committee of Efficiency and Economy, it may be quite amusing, but it's rather uncomfortable if you look at our heading along the top. Quite efficiency. And for those, just a sort of brief introduction to INSPIRE, there are a number of themes split into three annexes, and addresses fit very much into Annex 1 as a sort of core geography. But addresses doesn't sit as a theme in its own. If you look at geographical names, there must be a link between addresses and names because the names are part of the address. Cadastral parcels, we've already said that we're talking to the registers about linking the two gazetteers together, so we would actually somehow or other cadastral parcels in there. Transport networks, the One Scotland gazetteer can contain a street gazetteer. The street gazetteer becomes part of the integrated transport network or merged with the integrated transport network to create a transportation theme. So the gazetteer fits in quite a lot of these places. And then in the other ones, things like buildings. Buildings and addresses, well, definitely won't go into that here, but it's an absolute nightmare of saying, where do you stop when you're looking at buildings? Where does the address fit in? I mean, if you look at a university campus, a
You've got umpteen buildings which don't all have addresses. Should they all be in the ICT or I don't know. It's maybe something we're going to have to look at as we go through the journey into implementing Inspire. Remembering, of course, there'll be no extra funding and there's a lot of interdependencies here. It is all very complex how all of this stuff, these sort of themes fit together. And there's all sorts of threads running of where we can go. So what we really need to do is some sort of plan. And Cameron introduced the plan, which is a slide which most of you will have seen by now. And I won't try and explain it all, but basically it starts off at the bottom looking at the creation of data, how it's managed, how it's made available to people, how people can find it. It's all very well having all these themes of data, people have to find them, and then what people can do with them, how they can look at them, download them. And I think at the moment we're pretty well down at this sort of stage looking at how we get the data together. I think that's more or less where we are. But one of the things that we've been increasingly thinking about is we've always taken a public sector view of this, but there is a place for the private sector, for academia, all these other bodies that are involved in geography working together, because that's the only way we're actually going to deliver a Scottish SDI and people work together on it. And going back to the thing with no funding, we still need to have a plan of where we're wanting to go so that we're all working to at least a common purpose. Because if we don't have a plan, we can have this shiny vision of what it is that we're thinking about, and then with reality, I might not be able to see that terribly well, but that contains all the components of the previous picture. It's just they're not quite as good, they're not quite as shiny, but they're all there. So if we really don't have a plan of how we're going to link all these components together, this is what we're liable to end up with. And yet we're selling to the political masters and, you know, all of this. This is what we're saying. There is a bit of a warning in there, I think. Looking at some of the work that's been done for the next version of the One Scotland, One Geography strategy, we're saying that about just what we've said there, about local and central government working together more closely, data stored, collected ones, stored ones, and then made available to many organisations. You've got the thing where you've got 32 councils doing the same thing. Why are they doing it differently? They should be able to do once and use it 32 times. We need to promote all of this. I think you might have written these, Bruce. There are statutory obligations that organisations have, but we need to start looking at these things. We need to look at what we're doing. Why are we doing this? Not just because we've always done it. Are there some things that we need to do? Are there some things we can drop? Or are there other things that we can do in different ways? We've already said that there's no money. So what we have to do is local authorities and central government all working together and not just talking about this together, but actually doing things together and making it happen. And the key thing is it's not going to be funded. It has to be built piecemeal and each bit has to sort of earn its keep. But again, that's where this plan is important. If we're all doing our own wee bit of this, it can all get put together into a bigger picture. Just looking at some of the things we've done along this route, and this is where how I see Inspire and some of the issues in it. The gazetteer was one. It covers off the address layer, but you've got all councils working together. There was funding there. It's probably unique in that. There was an agreed standard, convention, quality assurance. That all took time to put in place, and it worked. Another project we've been involved with for conservation. Land use, open space, where each council's required to create a spatial catalogue of all its open areas, and it's done to a planning advice notice which says how to do it, and yet they still have to take consultants to aggregate the data into a standardised layer. And local development plans, all 32 councils had to make them available. Ideally, that data should be brought together and made available right across Scotland as a whole, but the councils all fought against that. They all did their own thing, so these local plans don't always join up particularly well at boundaries. And one of my concerns about Inspire is the Scottish Government
underestimates the role of local government as data providers. Local government itself wants to be involved in working in these things, but they need some sort of guidance to be told, this is what we're expecting you to do. And the difficulty is communicating the message about this, because once you start saying SDI, you get into this sort of thing that's quite big in the press and the television just now, council non-jobs, SDI coordinator or something like that. You know, you've got no chance. But the senior managers have to be made aware of this somehow, but they've got more pressing things in their mind, like what's happening next year financially. And councils are difficult places. I've worked in local government for some time. But about organisational structures. Pick your terrorist organisation, any of them. That's their organisational chart. No one knows what's going on except the one person who knows what's happening. The person at the top pulls some strings, needs to know. And unfortunately, councils are the same. It's almost exactly the same. You can't get away from it. And in one, it's a strength, the other, it's a weakness. That's their challenge, is how we infiltrate and wear them down. So looking at what this means for land and property, I think we're saying we've got to get rid of the silo mentality around information management. I think that's probably going to be the key to doing all of this, to say we're all in this together, let's see how we can work together. Why does everyone hold a copy of the information? There was some research that the Scottish Government had commissioned that hasn't been published yet, but they were looking at, if we took all the map libraries and all the One Scotland Mapping Agreement organisations and we replaced it with a sort of Google Maps web mapping service centrally run, and we got rid of all the different map libraries, the saving was estimated to be £20 million over 4 years. Now, that sort of figure makes your sort of senior people sit up and say, hey, there's probably something in that, because you're getting into the sort of sums of money that are quite important to save. The only trouble there is that the people who run these map libraries, many of them are thinking, this isn't a good idea, or it's a good idea for the other members, but not for us, because we're different. And there's a number of initiatives going on, certainly in two councils, Perth and Kinross and Dumfries and Galloway, who have basically outsourced all their GIS delivery, and it's all delivered via web services now, or 90% of it is, at very, very low cost. And that, I think, is probably the way that that's going to go. And the idea would be that the technology allows that to happen now, and what we should be looking at is creating these national layers of data for the SDI and providing tools where these layers can be maintained. You still keep the same people working locally and maintaining the data, but instead of doing it on their own server, on their own PC, they're sitting on their own PC, but they're doing the updates somewhere else. And once these updates are posted, everyone can see it. There's a very good example of that Historic Scotland have put together just to show the concept of how it works. It's really good, and I think that's the way forward. It also sort of thinks about maybe relaunching Scotless, which has been around for a long, long time. And Scotless, the idea was, the idea of Scotless was basically to build a sort of doomsday book of all the information about land and property in Scotland and make it accessible from one point. And there was a lot talked about it. There was a good pilot developed back in 2001. But, you know, why is it difficult? Or what's difficult? The actual doomsday book, it took them 18 months to create it in 1088 for England and Wales. Sent to Scotland, and you know they don't have compatibility problems between their systems and things like that. I think taxation was probably the main driver for it as well, to get to build a base of which they could raise funds to finance wars and things like that, and put together into the Doomsday Book. That was actually a Christmas present from my son and daughter last year, which says something, I think. It's quite an interesting read, I must say. There's a lot in there. Pity it didn't apply in Scotland. But the aim of Scotless was originally
was to provide a data set where you could find out anything about a piece of land or property from a single point of search. That was the aim of it. It would be facilitated by means of a gazetteer. Different suppliers of data would be, that could all be integrated. That would determine in a pilot to see how all the various bodies involved. There was local government, BGS, Ordnance Survey, Registers, Coal Authority were I think the initial partners in it. And they built quite a good sort of proof of concept idea. But that was nearly 10 years ago. But that's exactly, as I see it, what's in the current GI strategy. So what's changed? Well, the people behind the original Scotless idea, I think, of the vision, but the technology wasn't there then. Web services weren't around. What the original demonstrator was basically a CD where various people contributed spatial data sets, and it was passed around and running it off PCs as demos and things like that. But I think since then, the technology has changed hugely to make these things possible that they weren't before. And I think also, through the likes of the One Scotland Mapping Agreement, they have actually now got a sort of community of people who work together on a lot of these things, who at least know each other and have got a fair idea of what people are doing. That didn't exist 10 years ago. So I think that there is a very good chance that some of that is going to come into being. But why stop there? Because there's all sorts of information that's similar to that. Ownership information. Who owns what? Where is it? The stuff, that the information that registers hold. There's a lot of people got an interest in that. What's the best use of any particular site or area of ground? What are you allowed to do with it? What are you not allowed to do with it? And where's the financial incentives? Are there development grants available for doing things there? It's all spatial information. Where do people live? What sort of housing do they live in? What's the quality of life? Where's the leisure facilities? Where's education? All of that spatial information can be brought together. And environmental information, would it be safe, used here, or what's the likely cost? To bring all of that information together from all these different sources, create national layers of data to a standard, and then publish them. So this is another of these state changes. As we're sort of merrily going along with the One Scotland Mapping Agreement, that was all tied up then with free data. And then something unthinkable happened. You've got the two main protagonists in addressing over the years, local government and the Ordnance Survey, quite a bitter acrimony. And all of a sudden, a marriage took place, or has just taken place at the moment, between the Local Government Association and the Ordnance Survey to set up a joint venture to deliver a national address gazetteer. And I was looking actually for some clip art for weddings and stuff, and I found that, and Washington Post, and I now pronounce you Man and Property. So actually, the cartoonist didn't realise how apt it was for these circumstances. So really what we've got is this joint venture coming together to create a joint venture company to deliver a national address gazetteer, which I think, from a personal point of view, I think it's a really good idea. I think it's great that we've actually got this far after so many years of squabbling. A wee bit more about it. It's a joint venture, as I've said. Initially, it won't look very different to the existing products, but they'll all be badged under the National Address Gazetteer. NAG would be exclusively marketed by the Ordnance Survey using their existing distribution channels. It would be free at the point of use to members of the One Scotland Mapping Agreement and the Public Sector Mapping Agreement, the equivalent of England and Wales, and there are commercial revenues, and these will be split between Ordnance Survey and local government. And whoops, I spilled something over that, which we won't mention. How it could work? Okay, That's more or less how the One Scotland gazetteer works at the moment. The 32 councils feeding data into the Scottish gazetteer hub, and that is produced out as web services, downloads, change only updates, and soon to be OSG Lite to the customers. That's our production thing. We've got linkages into Royal Mail there, and the Assessors and Registers of Scotland. And some of these linkages we're establishing at the moment, but their plans are to strengthen these and to build that. In England and Wales, you've got about 380 local land and property gazetteers. You've got the Land Registry, the Valuation Office data, all brought into NAG. It's more or less the same process, the same services, the same standards. The procedures or the way in which organisations work are different, mind you. You've got 14 regional assessors opposed to the Valuation Office. Registers of Scotland, the Land Registry are a bit different, but it could all be brought together. And really, what the thing for NAG would be, would be to build a link between what we've done in Scotland and the National Address Gazetteer in England and Wales. And that would then allow us to have a true National Address Gazetteer, whilst we can preserve what we're doing for our existing customer base in Scotland, tie into the Scottish SDI, and meet our Inspire obligations, all of that, and still contribute into this National Gazetteer. As we've gone through this, we have noted, in terms of the gazetteer, that there is a commercial interest in it. Insurance companies, all sorts of people saying, well, you built this gazetteer, it's pretty good, can we get access to it? We've had to turn around up to them and say, no, sorry, you can't, because you're not a member. And the way in which the license is stacked up against you, you won't be able to afford it. We also know there's a demand for a GB addressing product. There's probably a demand for a UK addressing product, but Northern Ireland has so far been just sort of left until maybe we get Scotland sorted and then bring in Northern Ireland as well. We'd said before that we'd no policy for the brokerage of information, and to be honest, we've stood back and watched the arguments between Ordnance Survey and local government in England and Wales, just said we'll keep out of it, better to keep talking to people and keep the thing going. And I think, again, the One Scotland Mapping Agreement, the partnership element of that helped considerably. We had a dialogue going, so we didn't get into this rather acrimonious situation. So I think that's positive. I think this is the way in which we should be heading. And there's a lot of boxes ticked by the proposals. But there are quite a number of things that I don't think are quite sort of thought through yet. I don't think that the proceeds of NAG are distributed in accordance with the effort. I think there's still remaining questions about OS-derived data and IPR. But back to the previous slide, the arrows of where various people's data go, I think would need to be redrawn perhaps, or maybe they shouldn't, we don't know. I think the big issue that's causing me a lot of grief at the moment is that the people, the decision makers of Scottish Government and for local government are saying, well, wait a minute, these costs and all of this are not looking quite as good. But in England and Wales, they're hidden away under the PSMA. We've been a lot more open and transparent, which I think has surfaced some of these, which is causing concern at a very senior level. I think the marketing strategy for NAG could be different. The addressing market in the UK at the moment is £30 million a year for addressing products, of which Royal Mail take £24 million from half. So there's a big... There's a bit of a disparity there. And I always feel that we're trying to build a national address gazetteer without one of the three corners of the stool. But I think we really need to get all three parties working together to make this truly a national address gazetteer. I take the point that to try and get local government and the Ordnance Survey working together is a huge step. And GeoPlace is now there, it's in place. And if we had tried to go down the route of bringing Royal Mail in, we'd be talking about it for the next 5 years. So I think we've done it in a way that's a step forward, but I still think for it to be a true national address gazetteer, Royal Mail have to be involved.
So, so I'm quite happy to take questions, and as are some of the other people here.
Well, thanks very much. Interesting stuff. Questions? Robin.
Ian, with the census coming up this year, England and Wales, ONS spent a lot of time creating their own gazetteer to support the census. Can you explain what's happening in Scotland with the census and how your gazetteer might help that, that process?
Yeah, GROS have been using the gazetteer to verify their address databases that they use for the census. They have got a real concern, or the, well, they still do, but initially the census is one of these mission critical things. It has to happen on such and such a date. They could not take the risk that the gazetteer wouldn't support it. So over the last sort of 4 or 5 years, they've been using the gazetteer, they've been using PATH, and they've been using address point, address layer, looking at the various data sets, and have been people out on the ground verifying it. They have offered to feed that information back to us. There's certain legislation around about censuses, or information that's gathered as part of a census, of what you can do with it. But the argument is if, it's if people give that information out prior to the census, it can then be shared with others. So the idea would be that the work GROS has done will be used to improve the gazetteer. And we are in a dialogue with GROS.
Do you think that would be a much better gazetteer than your gazetteer? Given the amount of work and on the ground verification that's taking place?
Yeah, I think that's true. But if you look at it, it depends, because if you look at Royal Mail, there's a claim from Royal Mail that the PATH is so good because every postman, postwoman in the UK spends 15 minutes a week updating their logbook with changes. And we know that doesn't happen. So there's a whole lot of things that we do, you need to go and verify these addresses, because actually going out and looking at addresses, if you walk up and down the street, particularly around about here, for example, you will have real difficulties in getting the correct addresses for things. So, it's basically what I'm saying, ramble, is that what we're trying to do is get as many different sources of that information, pull it together, and actually make the gazetteer better, but not be precious about where that information comes from. It's almost like crowdsourcing a gazetteer, but from trusted sources, and GROS are one of them.
I think I would just add that, the good news the bad news is to try and keep this up to date is, you know, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. Speaking to National Health Service, we discover they have created their own asset management system with their own addresses in it, and they are talking to the Irish about standards for addressing. You know, and you start to think, my God, but the good news is when we speak to them and we point out the One Scotland Gazetteer that it is policy that you shall use this, that you are going to be caught by the Inspire Directive, suddenly the whole thing changes and they're saying, yes, we want to do this, give us your data, we'll incorporate this within our database, and what we can give you in return is some of the stuff that you talked about earlier on, you know, in terms of a campus, you know, a hospital campus has got one address, but actually it's got about 20 or 30 buildings, which is in their database and in your database. So if we can bring that in and, you know, as you said, what, crowdsource it or you know, however it is we're doing it, I think that's the power of where we've got to now. We've built up a momentum here, which allows us to answer Robin's question about the census, and it allows us to answer these problems about NHS and so on. So, you know, I think we've got a real momentum right there.
Angus?
Following on from that, what
are
the what's the error reporting sort of feedback mechanism? Is that sort of built in so that Joe Bloggs, who's interacting with the official system, can sort of pipe in, well, that's something hasn't happened, or that's wrong, or whatever. I've got a message from my little horrible
bit. Yep. And
it's always been lacking up till now, I think, all the addressing arguments. Yep. There's never been a ground level reporting system whereby somebody, like me, for example, the business centre in Mackenzie, there was an old Victorian school, lots of different units subdivided in there. And if you go in and try to get stuff delivered by or uploaded by parcel, of course, do an online service, go to their website. But as you watch your upload postcode, my unit wasn't listed, and 5E wasn't listed there. So I couldn't actually do an online parcel uplift. Phone them up on their RBL website, phone them up and say, oh, alright, eventually got through to, after five links in the chain, you eventually get to some technical look in some back office somewhere, a couple of weeks later, and there's my address, my postcode is listed, my unit is listed under the postcode, so I could actually use a partial force. I guess that's because I was using partial force, speaking Royal Mail, and so there's a direct link between Royal Mail and the partial force, and the folk can provide the postcode, and they can just do it. But if I'm using a courier company, for example, who are using that Royal Mail address list or whatever as a basis for their system, then, sorry mate, your postcode doesn't exist. You have to lift it, and so that's the end of the entire process, because you're not, the computer says no, and that's it. So I have a very long question.
Yep.
Probably about
it. And it's more than one. Right. PAF, Royal Mail's address product, which is what caused your problem. It depends how often the couriers update their database. If they take a copy from Royal Mail every 3 months, that's fine. You'll get 3 months, 6 months, you'll get 6 months. That is a big problem. And Royal Mail themselves have been carried out some research over the last year to find the percentage of people who've moved into new properties who have come across problems with their property not appearing on systems that are used to deliver things, to get insurance and all of that. And from memory, it was between 70 and 80% of people moving into new houses had that problem, because people are relying on the old network and PAF to deliver CDs, DVDs, and get loaded into multiple systems. Whereas if you use a web service, that's fine. So that's probably where that arose from, and that's not uncommon. In terms of what we've done in the Gazetteer, in the new Gazetteer management system, there is an unfortunate acronym again, a CRM, which is a change request mechanism web service, where if users find an address that they don't think is correct, they have got there's a box pops up that they can fill out, and that gets through the web service, gets delivered back through the hub to the local custodian, who would investigate and say, well, that is a mistake, or no, that's not a mistake, you're wrong. So that has been built into the new system to actually do that, because the way in which you get better information in your Gazetteer is, one, get people to use it, and two, tell you when it's wrong. Because they're better telling you it's wrong than telling everybody else. So we have built that in, but again, I still think if we could, Royal Mail working closer with NIBE, the whole thing could provide better services for people and stop that happening.
Can I just follow up from that? Talking about different versions for the same address or the same property, is that maintained in this Gazetteer?
Yes.
For example, flats, you can have different designation for flat 1 or flat 2,
yeah.
For example. And obviously the data that you receive is provided by different or from different sources. So.
Yeah, flats are a nightmare.
Yeah.
Because they're called different things all over the place. In fact, we were just looking at some of the ones around over here, and you've got sort of flats 1 to 9, and you've got flat 3F2 and things like that, all on the same street in Edinburgh. So flats are very, very difficult. But you can hold all sorts. The idea of having multiple LPIs is the BLP use the flat, that's the real world object. The LPI is the address label, which tells you the geographic address of it, and you can have many of these, and these are given a hierarchy. So what street naming and numbering, say, is the approved address, but you can hold all sorts of aliases and change over time. So that's one of the powers of it. But once you've got that, you've got a lot more
power and a lot better searches, but it gets more complex, it becomes a more complex data set to search through, which may slow down your searches, which goes against what we're saying about this OSG Lite product. But yes, is the short answer, you can have multiple address labels on any property.
Just one further point about how the addresses are geocoded. You mentioned that, I mean, I think the focus here is on generally local council, local authorities, so it's the UPRN, but is there then a link from that to the to MassMap?
That will come in NAIC.
The UPRN to the
NAIC
reference number?
NAIC will provide the cross-referencing between the UPRN, the OSAPR, and Tutoids as well. So that's one of the benefits, or one of the major benefits of going down the NAIC route.
Ian, you said a lot about, at various points of your talk, about increasing the usability of it, but who can use it and for what? Is it just central local government, or can I log on and use it? Can I set up applications to use it?
It's restricted for licensing reasons to members of the One Scotland Mapping Agreement.
Is that not a problem in terms of something that is a fundamental connecting data set for all sorts of other services?
I think on the slide about the free data sets, I think what we're getting at is the last one. There's a big debate there. Should addresses be free in the national interest? At the AGI conference in Stratford, in the last plenary session, Nigel Shadmore was actually asked that directly. Said, you know, well, you've included all these data sets, are you going to include addresses? And I think his response was definitely maybe, or maybe definitely. So I think, yes, I think there is a move, there's certainly a call for it, because it seems daft having this resource there and people can't use it.
Well, yes, I've got exactly the same problem with placing Gazetteer, that if you only make it available to a subset of applications, then you're still going to have a series of other alternative data sets being used, and there's then going to be incompatibilities between these, which kind of defeats the object of the exercise.
Yep. Although we have made the Gazetteer available through a separate website, which I could show you.
Can I use it? Am I allowed to use it?
Yes, anybody can.
I fear that we might have missed hope on this one. And had we been having this discussion a couple of years ago, there probably wouldn't have been a problem, because we would have been able to say, yes, of course, this is a national resource. We shall make it available nationally, free at the point of use, etc., etc. I fear when you look at the government budget curve, and we're starting to see a dip down, that public authorities are going to be looking at any asset that they have and a means to get cash back from that asset. And if they regard an address as an asset that commercial companies might wish to buy, then they may well be saying, well, we're going to get our pound of flesh out of this and we're going to sell this rather than make it available free. And it just worries me a wee bit that, you know, we're on the wrong end of a spending curve for some of this. Will that kind of data continue to feed? I'm not saying it's right or wrong, I'm just saying that's what worries me.
Yeah, I exactly see your point, but of course that's a very short-term view, because the longer-term view is that actually you save an awful lot more money than you ever charge the data set by removing all the duplication and ensuring that everybody's signed up to standard. And that, we hope, was the enlightened view that brought about, you know, OS3 and so on. But if that view then stops, that, well,
it's scary. It's scary. Yeah.
Can I add to Paul Barr's view of this is that the person who changes the information should be charged for it. So it's not a question of government needs to subsidize all this. There are other ways, business models can change. To accommodate this. But I reinforce the comment from Bruce. This is a core reference geography and must be free in the future. It's fundamental what we do, and there's so many savings to be made by that approach. Yeah.
I mean, the Scottish Government put the money up to build the One Scotland Gazetteer in 2003 with a view that it would be a public data set made publicly available, and that remains the position. It's not Scottish Government that has stopped it being published.
Colin, I think you're right now.
Ian, okay, yes, one question for you. I saw a paper a while ago that talked about the kind of attribute information that was going to be included in the gazetteer. Yeah. And it talked about that we're going to try and classify buildings by their use. I mean, that's the obvious point. Is it included in that information?
Yeah, we're working on that at the moment, because what we've done, if come back to the slide where we've got the assessor's data, that we've included, I think there was something like about 90% or 98% of council tax properties are related to the assessor's data. And it's about 70% of the non-domestic rate properties have been matched at a local level to the assessors. What we're looking at doing from the Gazetteer web service is to be able to connect into the assessor's record for that property and take the classification across. And that's one of the differences between the Scottish Gazetteer and NLPG, is that we've got multiple classifications for each property. So you define which is the classification scheme, and that's the classification. So yes, that's all work that's planned to be done. Just that it's a question of time. And it's also, unfortunately, these troubled times, as they say, we need to be sure that there's a market for it, that people may have to put some money into the matching process to get that work done. It's aimed at people who would like basically a shape file of the gazetteer, and they're working on it just now, but the initial idea is it will be a UPRN, a four-line address, a postcode, and a grid reference. So it's just these fields, but all the fields that are used to concatenate the four-line address, like the primary addressable object name, secondary addressable object name, all these other ones that are in the gazetteer, will also be included in it. So you can just delete these as columns if you don't want them, but it means that they're there if you've got a developer who wants to build searches on them. You know, you don't have to search on the concatenated field, you can search on the components of it as well.
The 32 councils producing these property gazetteers, how embedded are these property gazetteers within each of the councils in terms of their information systems and them using that gazetteer as their corporate address database from which their core critical business data?
Good question. We canvassed all the councils about 3 or 4 years ago to see how they were getting on with that, and we've got information. We have come back to them in the last month, and the first 6 that come back show a significant increase in embedding the gazetteer into the core business systems. Some councils have built, particularly North Lanarkshire Council, have basically tied up the whole back office into the gazetteer and the UPRNs, and another council who's done an awful lot of work recently is Glasgow, who have built the gazetteer web service into their SAP application, which drives their HR, all their various systems, which they then put out to other councils. So it's something that's increasing. As the gazetteer, the new GMS that's now live allows us to speed up the access to the web services, and there's an increasing amount of integration going on, because that is actually one of the keys to making the gazetteer sustainable in the longer term. Because if they're using it in their core business systems, they have to keep it up to date.
Yeah.
There are some councils who are not quite as enlightened yet.
My business is finding out where schools are after the space analysis on that. And it's also an English look of advice, but it's just a nightmare getting a school gazetteer, which is just a flat file, a spreadsheet, but like you described, OS Lite, your OS dealer, do you like that? Just but with the establishment number, the official reference number of the school in that as well, because educational departments traditionally are very non-geo savvy. spatial analysis using just desktop GIS. I mean, the starting point of any spatial analysis is very, very difficult. So I'm just wondering if I could I go to you, or could I get a definitive school council tier for Scotland list of all the schools, not a campus based thing, just a address point tile type grid reference, a single point that with all the the relevant lookup stuff, the cross reference.
Once the classifications are finished, yes. Because I mean, if you're classifying the property by type as a school, we haven't got that yet. So the only other way you'd be able to do it would be a search on the name, which wouldn't be.
That's kind of not what I would want to do. If the aim is a sort of one-stop shop for national geographic objects.
Yeah, but you're getting into application specifics there.
Sort of not. I would have, wearing a citizen hat, I would have thought just a list of all the schools in Scotland and where they are would be, isn't application specific. Yes, I want to do this particular thing with it, but it's not that.
But if you get to the stage where every property record is classified, you would be able to extract anything that's classified as a school from it.
Right.
But that's not done yet.
That would be the local authority classifying it as a school.
Yes.
So.
Or the assessor, because you will have schools that are not local authority.
Yes.
So, again, it's like I was saying that if we're putting these classifications in place, we need to know that people want to use them and then work out how to do them. But it would just be another classification scheme in the gazetteer. An example of that, which may sound bizarre, is that the gazetteer doesn't contain ward information. It doesn't say which council ward it's in. But that is something the councils want, but no one else, or most other people, are not particularly interested in. So how do you go to the work of putting all these different things without having a gazetteer that's got, tens of hundreds of different attributes, classifications? That it's something that has to be done, but it has to be done in a sort of managed way. And the idea of a different classification schemes allows us to do that. But there is a cost associated with creating these classification schemes, and we would need people to say yes, we want it, we're willing to put some money into it. So if education department said that they wanted it, but there's good news for you, that we're working with CMIS, who are the management information system suppliers to the majority of local authority schools, to tie them into the gazetteer. So we're going to be putting these classifications and school catchment areas onto the gazetteer. I'll tell you more about that online.
Yeah. It sounds like they're moving in the right direction.
Maybe not moving as fast as you would like, but it is.
But the key thing is joining that up at the local level, because I'm doing work for one bit of the council, but they have to get the schools, which is not generally education, it's not transport, whatever, they have to get a list of schools from the education department, which may or may not have good references, so maybe the good references have to come from the GIS. People, so that all gets tied up together and then sent to me, and I can do some spatial analysis. I've just had a very large local authority in England tell me that most of the schools were in the wrong place after I'd done the geoanalysis, because they'd all been geocoded to code point many years ago. And this was their definitive address for the definitive school gazetteer file, and the bottom line would be. Really wanted to do spatial analysis, and it was just really created so we could do an A4, an A3 map of general locations of schools. And really wanted to do spatial. You just can tear your hair out at that sort of meeting. That's because internally they're not tied up. I mean, as you know, there are both folk here who work for a GIS section in a big organisation. You're just a little, very, very small club. And a huge big machine. And you can do stuff, do great standards, whatever, but unless the stuff you do, unless it's actually incorporated in the business system, then you're probably an individual quite low down in sort of the food chain of an organisation to enforce that, you know, this kind of it's basically a back office technical standard, isn't it? But all the addressing stuff in this organisation has to be referenced to this kind of file here. It used to be that file here on some on their server or whatever, somebody's waiting for, in this case, to move on. But it's the internal joining up between the four different organisations that are creating their bit of the national thing that is, I think, always been the weakness of these big national things.
Right. I think we should possibly sum up there. Just before I thank Ian, who's certainly with his mention of Christmas Day, outlined very clearly how something that's obviously on Christmas Day, when you're explaining it very simple, becomes horrendously complicated and seemingly unnecessarily so at times. And there are many, many issues and parties, players involved. I think he's done a good job of that. Very interesting talk, and judging by the range of faces around the room and some of the questions, it's been rather good. But just before I thank Ian, I should just say that I think we will reconvene due to the age of austerity in the Teviot library bar this week, which actually, despite the austerities, happens to be quite nice, and they do a pretty good pass at a very reasonable price as well, should you need to eat. So I think we will retire there for further debate and drinky booze. But thank you everyone for coming, and thank you very much indeed for an interesting talk. The next talk will be on the 11th of March. Graham Clark from Leeds University, talking about microsimulation.